Production. Recorded live.
All right, this is going to be a semi-informal show. It's Sunday, November 15th, 2009, and any guest listeners are invited and indeed encouraged to call in if they wish to, and the number to do that would be 1-724-444-7444. Call ID is 31407, so if you want to call in, you're more than welcome to do so. And Bill Fink is joining us today. How are you, sir?
How you doing? What are you and Praise Yahweh? What are you and Nico usually talk about on this program? I'm guilty of never listening to this program because I usually use this time to do other things, and I'm always at something. So I don't know what you usually talk about here.
I'm guilty of not listening to a lot of programs just because I'm not home when they're on. So. Normally, we were going to talk about cultural degeneracy in Scandinavia with a special emphasis on Sweden, but we've rescheduled that for next week since that's going to be Nico's forte, basically.
Yeah, that's definitely a Nico topic. I've never been to Scandinavia. It's one thing amazes me is the liberalism of Scandinavians.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
And they don't – it's not a guarded liberalism. I mean, liberalism is fine in a homogenous society where you have all Christian people.
Mm.
However, the liberalism of the Scandinavians is basically race blind, and they're just eaten by worms because of that. That's the way I look at it. They're being destroyed because of that.
Absolutely. Well, one thing we're going to get into, you'll have to listen for next week when we expound on it in detail. It's the men in Scandinavia, about 50% of them have expressed interest in breastfeeding their children, and some men there are even taking hormone drugs so they start producing milk so they can breastfeed their own children.
Wow, you know, that is sickening. What would cause that? I've had six kids. My wives have had six kids, and I've never had that urge. That's just not a very masculine urge.
Then again, you're not a Judaized pansy.
That's incredible. How could a man want to breastfeed his children? That's not.
You have to wonder. Some men said they wish they could.
Wow.
They could get hairy children. But I think the average Scandinavian, basically the average European today, is not really worth a whole lot, are they?
No, they're all engaging in. From what I understand, and you know, I've met some Germans over the years, some people from Europe over the years, some Dutch, and they all seem to be highly effeminized, and they all dabble in homosexuality and sexual deviancy. That's my impression of them. Maybe not the older generation, but the younger ones. And I'm not saying it's not going on here, but it seems to be that we're only following trends that they set and not vice versa.
Absolutely.
When it comes to drug experimentation and well, if you want to call it sexual experimentation, it's really sexual deviancy.
Hmm. Well, some of the things that they're pushing now, they're following this UN curriculum that recommends that children as young as five be taught about masturbation in schools, and there's some Jewish doctor, so-called, in Germany who recommends that parents begin stimulating the sex organs of their three-year-olds to help them explore their sexuality. I mean, doesn't that just sound like something right out of the Talmud?
Absolutely, but not even the Frankfurt School could have done that. That's totally perverted. And that's the Jewish dream is basically to break down all barriers to free love. The free love movement is 100% Jewish movement. That they did it in Russia. They did it in Bolshevik Russia. That was what it was all about. It was about the satisfaction of their satanic lust.
Well,
what it was.
Free love in the Soviet Union was more than just that. I'd like to read from Russia number 1, a collection of reports on Bolshevism in Russia. This is Telegraph number 21, General Pool to the War Office, received January 12, dispatched January 11, 1919. From intercepted radios and leaflets, it is clear that to allay hostility abroad, Bolsheviks are conducting double campaign. Leaflets are distributed among German troops, while decrees which are not intended to be put into force and appeals are radioed to Berlin, which show Bolsheviks in sufficiently liberal light to bring them into line with German socialists. Appeals to unite and force worldwide revolution are made at the same time the proletariats. It is manifest from numerous deserters and refugees from Central Russia. Efforts to destroy social and economic life of country have not abated. There is evidence to show that commissariats of free love have been established in several towns and respectable women flogged for refusing to yield. Decree for nationalization of women has been put into force and several experiments made to nationalize children. I trust His Majesty's government will not allow peace conference to be influenced by Bolshevik presentation of their case abroad, as their action at home is diametrically opposed to this. So the Jew talks about free love with the implication that it will just simply allow a woman to choose her sexual partners however many she wants, however often she wants it. But in reality, it just means that any Jew that wants to go with a white woman will get her, and if she refuses, they'll beat her severely.
Well, that's what, you know, it's all a campaign to totally break down the racial barriers, because that's what the Jew seeks. It's all about the destruction of Christendom, because that's what the Jew seeks. And the bottom line is that if we had not, for the most part, lost the cultural war, we would have had to deal with a Soviet invasion. I'm sure. The Cold War ended the way it did. The so-called Cold War ended the way it did because America ceded the cultural war.
We capitulated.
Yes, absolutely. If we did not capitulate the cultural war, we would have had a military conflict.
Absolutely. And I'd like to read Mein Kampf, page 184. The black-haired Jewish youth lies in wait for hours on end, satanically glaring at and spying on the unsuspicious girl whom he plans to seduce, adulterating her blood and removing her from the bosom of her own people. The Jew uses every possible means to undermine the racial foundations of a subjugated people. In his systematic efforts to ruin girls and women, he strives to break down the last barriers of discrimination between him and other people. The Jews were responsible for bringing Negroes into the Rhineland with the ultimate idea of bastardizing the white race, which they hate, and thus lowering its cultural and political levels so that the Jew might dominate. For as long as a people remain racially pure and are conscious of the treasure of their blood, they can never be overcome by a Jew, the Jew. Never in this world can the Jew become master of any people except a bastardized people. That is why the Jew systematically endeavors to lower the racial quality of a people by permanently adulterating the blood of the individuals who make up that people. Now, isn't this a scriptural theme right here? He seems to be taking this right out of scripture. He realizes that miscegenation is the adulteration of blood.
Absolutely.
And that's simply...
He was absolutely a Christian, and he was a great Christian. And the nigger lovers like Arlene Johnson that want to try to claim that Hitler was a Jew and Hitler was this and that, history proves it's quite the opposite.
Absolutely, and I said earlier to my father that anybody who will not read Mein Kampf has no right to form an opinion of Hitler, since all they know is what the Jewish TV has told them.
Absolutely, that's an absolutely accurate opinion. Most Americans, most people in the world, get all of their education from the Jewish media. Everything they think they know actually comes from the Jewish media or the Jewish. Yeah, you know, when I speak of the media, I include the media companies that now own all of the textbook producers. The people that produce our college and all of our school textbooks are Simon and Schuster's, owned by Viacom and News Corp, or all of these big media conglomerates have come to own all of these textbook producers. All of them, Grolier, they've all caved in to the media buyouts of the 80s and 90s. So what do we have? What instruction do we have?
Well, one thing when speaking with my dad, I pointed out that every American has heard of the hoax of cost, and the jury's pretty much still out on that. We need to investigate it thoroughly, but we're not permitted to, either by law in some countries or social convention in others. You're not allowed to ask the tough questions, so we're simply left guessing. We're basically told that we have to take the Jew on his word that it happened, and, well, I'm not going to take the Jew on his word over anything. If the Jew told me the sky was blue, I'd want to go outside and confirm it. And I said, yet, in my history book, in AP European and AP American history, they have an entire chapter on the hoax of cost, yet when talking about Stalin, they simply mentioned that he was the leader of the Soviet Union and he was our ally in the Second World War. End of story.
Well,
which is incredibly dishonest.
Except for the hard sciences, there's nothing true in any of our books, in any of our textbooks.
Absolutely.
And there's no hope for an improved situation as long as these as long as Christians embrace Jews and these Jews are able to control our entire media. Because now they control also our entire educational establishment, and they've cemented that through total control over textbook production.
I'm just typing here in the chat. Somebody wanted to know about Russia number one. I'm just going to say here, a copy appears on your Mein Kampf Christogena site thanks to the scanning work that Gerald and I did, and thanks to Gerald for providing the copy that we scanned.
Right. So, Russia number one was a British intelligence report on the nature of the Bolshevik Revolution that reveals in 1919 that the Brits understood that the entire Bolshevik movement and the communist Soviet Russian revolution was 100% Jewish. It was all Jewish. And they knew that then. And it was hushed up later. But the Russia number one is the first major British intelligence report. And it basically told the truth.
I'd say it's not a matter of it was hushed up later. It was hushed up in weeks.
Well, yeah, it was hushed up right soon after Russia number one was published. It was taken down. It was taken down from the markets. And a different abridged report was published a short time later.
And it removed all references to Jews.
Yes, it did.
And they even went so far as to ask people that had an original copy to return it because they needed it. And they said that they would take care of them and get them an abridged one later or a modified one. They said that basically everyone, in order to be a good citizen, should turn in their copies because the government needs them.
I just put a link in to the forum where I have it on the Mein Kampf site.
Okay, great.
It's at mk.christogenia.org, and you have to look for something called, on the right-hand side on the menu under Books by Others, you'll find a facsimile library, and that's a link to all of the, I will eventually have all of the text to all of these old and rare books, I hope, posted on my website, but the OCR process and the editing process is way beyond my capacity to devote time to it. So in the meantime, I put all these books up on my website in images. And I have about 50 more books coming in the near future. But they'll all be up in images until I can get them converted.
Okay. And I'd like to read a quote from Woodrow Wilson, the arch-Marxist that he was, the useful idiot, the tool. He had a comment on the Bolshevik Revolution. In 1917, as it was erupting, he said, quote, "Does not every American feel that assurance has been added to our hope for the future peace of the world by the wonderful and heartening things that have been happening within the last few weeks in Russia? Russia was known by those who knew it best to have always been, in fact, democratic at heart in all the vital habits of her thought, in all the intimate relationships of her people, that spoke their natural instinct, their habitual attitude toward life. The autocracy that crowned the summit of her political structure, long as it had stood and terrible as was the reality of its power, was not in fact Russian in origin, character, or purpose, and now it has been shaken off, and the great, generous Russian people have been added in all their naive majesty and might to the forces that are fighting for freedom in the world, for justice and for peace. Here is a fit partner for a league of honor." Now, who but a communist or a useful idiot could make a remark like that?
Absolutely. That's communism is only a political vehicle for the Talmudism. That's all it is. Bolshevism and Talmudism are one and the same.
Absolutely. And we're going to get into that later tonight, so I'll save my quotes on that, on my notes on that. I have several pages worth. But I just thought, you know, here's Woodrow Wilson talking about freedom, and he says that the czarists were not Russian in origin, character, or purpose, that they were some sort of imposed system from outside of Russia, unnatural and anti-Russian. Yet, what are the Jewish Bolsheviks? How many of them were even born in Russia to begin with, you know?
Well, it's very possible that Mandelhaus handed Wilson that quote and told him to read it to the press.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Wilson was more or less a flunky. More evil came on this country during Wilson's administration. And the best way to sum it all up is, and the Barnes Review gave him this, the title of American Nero, about 10 years ago. And that fits. It fits perfect. Woodrow Wilson is, he brought us not only the Federal Reserve and the graduated income tax, women's suffrage, World War I, the League of Nations. The Bolshevik Revolution was funded and operated on his watch. I mean, all the evil in the world just exploded during his presidency. All the evil that's befallen our nation has exploded upon us during the Wilson presidency.
Well, I was posting on a conservative Second Amendment forum, so-called conservative. They were discussing the internment of the Japanese, and I said that what I find to be an absolute atrocity is that tens of thousands of Italians and Germans were interned, many of them second-generation immigrants, and they were held in most instances until 1948 to 1949. Obviously, they wouldn't have ever been able to get away with locking up everybody in America of German or Italian ancestry, as the country was probably 20% German and Italian. However, they doubtlessly would have done such a thing had it been practical. The Morgenthau Plan literally called for the destruction of Germany, the seizure of all German industry, the devastation of all German agriculture, and the death of every German man, woman, and child. In short, nothing less than the obliteration of Germany by obliterating the Germans. It stands to reason if the government of the United States wanted to kill every German in Germany, and probably every Italian in Italy, they would have also liked to have been able to kill every German in America and every Italian in America. For those who didn't know about it, I suggest they investigate and read the Morgenthau Plan. Mind you, Henry Morgenthau was the Secretary of the Treasury of the United States under FDR. I then went on to say, the Japanese were released almost as soon as the war ended. The Germans and Italians were held for anywhere from 3 to 4 years after the war ended, yet few people even know that there were Germans and Italians locked up in camps, and I have been called a liar when I try to discuss this, despite the fact that it is documented. Germany did not attack the United States of America, nor did Italy. Indeed, as early as 1940, FDR issued orders that American naval ships were to sink German U-boats as soon as they located them. This ultimately culminated in the sinking of the Reuben James, a U.S. destroyer, by a German U-boat in an act of desperate self-defense on 31 October 1941. Also on 17 October 1941, the USS Kearney was heavily damaged after a U-boat retaliated against the dropping of depth charges. American ships were being used to protect British shipping, and they were regularly attacking, even sinking, German U-boats. This was going on in 1940 and certainly increased in frequency throughout 1941. Roosevelt was waging a very silent, yet certainly very unconstitutional, naval war against Germany without the backing of the American people and without authorization from Congress. Just as Woodrow Wilson won an election on the promise of keeping us out of war, he immediately got us in the war, a world war. Just as FDR promised to keep us out of the war, he won re-election and immediately brought us into a world war. And then again, as a quote I read from Douglas Reed, I'll read again. I say, to quote the South African author Douglas Reed, page 115, The Battle for Rhodesia, in three lengthy sojourns in America, I felt the subsurface apprehension or fear of the future more and more tangibly. I think its cause is becoming clear. It lies in my diagnosis and comprehension of today's America. Americans have lost earlier beliefs because these have been taken from them. They have no clear sense of purpose because none is now to be discerned. American state policy, as declared, is to maintain America as a citadel of the free world against the further inroad of the destructive revolution bent on obliterating race, nationhood, familyhood, and religion. American state actions since 1917 have progressively promoted the spread of that revolution. No adult American can remain blind to this contradiction between word and deed. Two stricken presidents, each reelected on the promise of peace, brought America at once into world wars, which in the sequel, after victory, increased the area and power of the revolution. Now, isn't it just startling how most Americans seem to have some disconnect? They have some sort of cognitive dissonance going on where they hear the government talk about freedom and liberty, yet at the same time the government supports communism, and they can't connect the dots.
It is amazing, and there's really no easy explanation for that. I mean, I don't have one. I don't understand how Americans, and not all Americans did, but a great majority of them did. They think that Woodrow Wilson is, I'm sorry, that Franklin Roosevelt was basically a savior. He did absolutely nothing to end the Depression.
Absolutely.
Not
In fact,
one policy of his assisted in ending the Depression. The only thing that assisted in ending the Depression is that as soon as the country agreed to enter into war to destroy Germany, which is what the Jews really wanted to do, all of a sudden there was lots of money in the economy so that companies can tool up for war.
The Jewish bankers pumped the economy up once we agreed to destroy our cousins in Europe.
Well, that's our biggest fault is not understanding how money works. That's our biggest fault. That's the biggest fault of our race, is that we don't understand how money works. And because we don't understand how money works, the Jews are able to deceive us and control our economy. I can't think of any greater fault. Most people have no idea how money works.
I
They
think
have no idea that it's just manufactured out of thin air and used for the exchange of goods, except that the people that manufacture it reap all the benefits of it. It's crazy.
another deception I've noticed, and particularly on this Second Amendment form, there's a Romanian Jew who repeatedly says that it doesn't matter that Germany and France and Britain are being taken over by Muslims and that demographics have changed. Another poster said that he's greatly concerned about the demographic catastrophe and crisis that is plaguing Western civilization. And this fiend, this Jew, says that immigrants are still moving in there and they'll carry on Western civilization when the Frenchmen, the Germans, and the British are gone, and when the Anglo-Americans are gone, the Latinos are here and they'll continue American civilization. And he tries to cite the example of the British Empire, claiming how many Brits did it take to subjugate the world. He says that population numbers mean nothing today, and that your concern about being swamped by them, as opposed to having more of your people in this country, is simply thinly veiled bigotry. So I came in here and I sided on the side of this other poster, and I said that such a view of the British Empire is based on fundamental ignorance as to how the British Empire came about and how it was sustained. Have you ever heard of the Sepoys? The British Empire relied heavily on collaborators in the territories that they colonized. India was never colonized so much as it was subverted and co-opted. They appealed to the most corrupt tribal leaders who sold out their own people for trinkets from the British and provided the British with military manpower in exchange for luxury items and various pieces of European technology. India was basically 50 million British colonial administrators and army officers put in place above 300 million people, with a number of British settlers so low it is not even worth mentioning. As Stoddard predicted in 1920, the British would be expelled from India when the Indians refused to play ball with them and decided not to sustain the colonial administration, not to buy, not to sell, not to deliver food, etc. Basically, the Indians told the British to pack up and go home, and the British had no alternative except the use of massive military force, which they elected not to use. At that point, when they were ejected from India, it is doubtful that even massive military force would have succeeded in taming the country and pacifying the population. I then basically went on to say, as goes the Western man, so too go his ideas, his institutions, his way of life, and his thoughts on government and society. When the last Western man is gone, Western civilization is gone for all time, and with it, the idea of a Western republic. I asked this Jew, if you can think of a social or political, non-biological reason, but please tell me why the idea of a republic never formed in the mind of a Saudi. Feel free to do so, because I would like to know. And this Jew won't respond to me. He never does. But they've created this idea in the minds of our people that we're nothing special, that our culture, our ideas, our institutions can be carried on by other races. So it doesn't really matter if Britain has a birth rate below the replacement level because immigrants are moving into Britain, and surely, they'll be just as good as the Brits.
Well, that goes back to the same source of where we get our education from. I'm sorry, it it all leads back to square one. If Christians embrace the Jews, this is what happens.
Mm.
English Christians embrace the Jews, and the foremost, the foremost to blame, I think, is the British Israel movement, which actually had a great deal of the true English nobility. I mean, men like Rudyard Kipling and there were a great many educated Britons who were involved in this movement, and they embraced the Jews as Judah instead of cracking the books and answering the hard questions. They took it for granted the Jews were Judah, they were Israel, and we're all brothers. And look at the shape of England today. Embrace the Jews, and that's what happens.
So they unknowingly advanced the Marxist cause, as Hitler says on page 96 of Mein Kampf. I consider the disastrous policy of the Triple Alliance as one of the consequences resulting from the disintegrating effects of the Marxist teaching. For the alarming feature was that this teaching was invisibly corrupting the foundations of a healthy political and economic outlook. Those who had been themselves contaminated frequently did not realize that their aims and actions sprang from this Weltanschauung worldview, which they otherwise openly repudiated. He then goes on to say, long before then, the spiritual and moral decline of the German people had set in, though those who were affected by the morbid decadence were frequently unaware, as often happens, of the forces which were breaking up their very existence. Sometimes they tried to cure the disease by doctoring the symptoms which were taken as the cause. But since nobody recognized or wanted to recognize the real cause of the disease, this way of combating Marxism was no more effective than the application of some quack's ointment. And it seems that our people are often able to recognize symptoms, but they never really recognize the underlying cause. Because their worldview has been so contaminated and tainted that they don't understand that even though they would repudiate communism if you started waving a red banner and screaming, workers unite, and it's time to rise up, and, you know, death to the clergy, death to the nobles, death to everybody, long live the proletariat. They would tell you to go to hell. They would pick up a rifle and oppose you. Yet they don't realize that they are culturally Marxist. They've been contaminated by the schools, mass media, and the churches.
And we are programmed to be unracially aware. Not to be racially aware. And that's a huge downfall. We don't have any racial awareness whatsoever.
So most Americans...
As a rule. Most Americans, even if you mention any differences based on race, you get automatically scoffed at. And it takes a long time to teach somebody. And a lot of them, and most people won't listen that long. That they reject you They criticize you and judge you, and they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear that cultural differences are because of the qualities of certain races.
Well, I wrote that in an essay in my senior year in high school. I said that culture comes from race. Race gives rise to culture. Cultures don't make a race. The race makes the culture, and a culture is simply a reflection of the race that it comes from.
Absolutely. That there's no doubt that that can be attested to in history over and over and over again, that the white race has been the creator of every advanced culture in history.
Well, I asked
that
people
Jew on that. Is basically the merchant banking class has been the destroyer of that of every advanced culture in history.
That's why the Jew advances the unnatural concept of citizenship simply by nationality or citizenship by birth as opposed to citizenship by blood. I put forth the idea, and a number of people agree with me, but the Jews never respond when I post on these forums. I asked, were I to marry a Russian woman, temporarily relocate to Syria, and she gave birth to my son in Syria, would anybody identify him as a Syrian? Would I say, this is my son, he's a Syrian? You would expect to see a brown-skinned Arab, not a white American,
and
rightly so.
That's to a great degree our own fault. We have always identified each other by geography, and it is once we do that, it is so easy to confuse the issues. I mean, Ruth was a Moabite. David was an Ephrathite. There was the Gileadite. The people all the way back in biblical history, have we we see that we've identified ourselves by geography, which only makes sense in a homogenous society. It makes no sense at all in a multiracial society.
If anyone can be from any region.
Right, and you don't know what you're getting, like we have today.
Well,
but 200 years ago, a New Yorker was white. I mean, 99.999% of the time.
Well, an example I gave, I was talking with my dad, and I said that if it was 1910 or 1920, and we cabled Japan and said the American ambassador is coming, they knew to expect a clean-cut white guy. He'd probably be a practicing Christian, and he'd probably be conservative in outlook, and he'd probably be decently honest and fair with them. Today, it could be a gay, black, bisexual, atheist, communist Jew, and they can't believe a word out of its mouth.
Right. You know, one of the first examples of this in the Bible is where the children of Benjamin more or less stuck up for the sons of Belial. The sons of Belial raped and killed this woman. And the husband had cut her body up into 12 pieces and sent them out into the land with notes attached to them, explaining that this happened to his wife. His wife was raped and killed in the land of Benjamin. And the Israelites gathered and confronted the Benjaminites. And the Benjamin and it was sons of Belial is how they're described in Scripture that actually perpetrated this. But the children of Benjamin went to war with all the balance of the children, you know, all the rest of the Israelite tribes over this in order to protect the sons of Belial.
Well, they
and
should have killed the sons.
The word Belial in Hebrew means, I mean, the concordance says it means worthless. But when you look at the root of the word, it means mixed. That's what it means. And that's why it means worthless. Belial means mixed.
So they were the sons of mongrels.
Exactly. That raped this woman, and the tribe of Benjamin stuck up for them, and 90% of the tribe was wiped out.
That's
or better.
Hideous. Horrible.
And that's, you know, that's a lesson that Bible teachers don't teach because they don't see it. They don't investigate. They don't know it. And they don't look at the racial aspect of things.
Well,
it's all religious. It's all idealism. This race has nothing to do with it in their purview. And
well,
their wealth in Shang is corrupt, and it was created by the Jews.
Well, if we accept that sort of outlook and that sort of perspective, then if some American Negro who happens to be a Somalian goes to Somalia, gets mixed up with terrorists and militants and gets himself kidnapped, they will risk the lives of white special forces to go in there and rescue his sorry butt, yet he's not one of us and he's not worth an ounce of American blood. But because they have a warped concept of who is a citizen and who is a fellow countryman, they'll pay any price then, won't they?
Right. And it's sickening. Multiculturalism is always destructive, there's no doubt.
And so even our ancient Israelite ancestors were practicing this filth.
Well, the mistake of identifying people geographically, I'm trying to say, is 5,000-year-old mistake. It's not a new mistake, and we do it today. We're brothers by blood. We're not brothers by geography. Nobody's my brother by geography. It means nothing. Just because you happen to be born down a street, that means nothing to me. In fact, if you're not white, it's a reproach to me that you even live down a street.
Well, I feel more affinity for the Russian peasant in Siberia living in a village who I've never met than a Negro who lives four doors down.
Well, that's the way it should be. We should feel a much greater allegiance to the average white Breton than to a nigger that lives next door in New York. I mean, of course. And Americans are screwed up. And we think regionally. And we've always done that. And it's wrong. And that's our biggest downfall. You don't sign on with somebody just because they live in the next town.
Well, what can be done to correct this tainted worldview? Is there anything we can do that you
there's
could
nothing
see
we could do. There's nothing we could do. I mean, it's the educational system in this country is corrupt from the ground up. I have no idea. People have to get woken up for themselves. Yahweh has to wake people up. We can't wake them up. It can't be done.
And we can't count on teachers, professors, or any of them, because they're supporting the system. They are a critical component in this brainwashing, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Since they're either so brainwashed themselves, they don't know what real history is, or they are ideologically compromised, and they are going to teach a lie anyway. I had a teacher that was a out-and-out leftist, and he tried to put forth this idea in my senior year of high school that the Dutch landed in southern Africa, massacred millions of blacks, enslaved millions more, and then they went on to rape half the continent. And I basically said that that's just not so. The Dutch landed in the Cape area, what's now Kapstad, Cape Town, in approximately 1652, give or take. And for about 200 to 300 miles in any direction, it was a void, a barren void, just a vast stretch of open land waiting to be settled and tamed. They encountered a few Hottentots and Bushmen living in scattered tribes and clans, basically, throughout the Kalahari Desert along the western, northwestern portion of South Africa, along what's now the border of Namibia. But other than that, the whole country was empty. So they poured in and they settled it, and then the British came and tried to steal it from them, so they trekked on, and by now they encountered the Zulu and the other Kaffirs, primarily the Xhosa, who were coming in from the north. And
well,
the
English, I believe, armed them and sent them in from the north.
Yeah.
That's the story I remember reading.
But they had to fight 9 Kaffir wars, 9 wars to secure their existence against the Zulu and the Xhosa and all the other Kaffir tribes who the British were arming and basically setting upon them.
I forget the name of the river, but when the Dutch first settled South Africa, there was a certain river there, and there weren't none of the Negro tribes were none of the black tribes, I should say, were below that particular river, except for the occasional Bushmen.
Was it the Orange River, the Limpopo River?
I honestly don't remember, but that river basically demarcated the lands of the black Africans with lands that were virtually non-inhabited.
And then this teacher told me that if I kept talking like that, I might notice my grade slipping. That's what he told me. He took me aside and said that. And I said that if you'd like to hold my grade hostage, then maybe you'd like to speak with my attorney. And I wound up, you know, nothing negative ever happened to my grade.
Well, you know, because you're going against the dogma, the established dogma, and they don't want to hear that. It's the same thing when we discuss the settlement of America. You can't purport in a university today that white people may have been here before the red man.
Well, I don't necessarily believe that, but I believe we are the rightful owners through a bargain for exchange, that we bought and paid for this land. And I've pointed out to people that the red man in this continent has no concept of private property ownership. The same with the Aborigines in Australia. I speak with white Australians. They had the exact same problem in their country that our people had in this country. Our ancestors would land. They would trade Indians useful goods, blankets, beads, weapons, tools, livestock, thinking that, okay, these Indians are giving us this land. We now have exclusive rights and exclusive ownership over this land that we have bought and paid for. And in the Indian's mind, he thought, ha, 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 these foolish white men, they give us useful goods for something no one can own, because no one can own the land, because the land belongs to the great spirits and it belongs to Mother Earth and nature. And they continued using the land as though they still owned it. They would graze the cattle that we gave them on the land that we paid for. They would just come on and take game off the land. And they would even take more livestock, too, because they didn't believe anyone could own animals. So then we had to fight to secure the land that we had already paid for. So they thought they were pulling a fast one on us and getting a lot of stuff for nothing. So we had to fight, and in the end, we won. I feel no sympathy for them because they were scam artists.
Well, I think that our first fault is trying to even bargain with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, we should have just pushed them out in the first place. That's what I believe.
Well, I think we were more than fair to them.
But life is unfair. That's the way it is.
We're told that we were oppressors, rapists, and that we killed them and massacred them and this and that, but we were more than fair to them. We gave them much more than they deserved.
In fact, we were. However, there is a lot of evidence that shows that there were actually Caucasoid people here at a very early time, and
mm-hmm.
Mongols from Asia were not the first people to settle this land.
Well, I'm saying that there may very well be the case, but whether or not this continent is ours by right of first discovery or right of purchase, I think is immaterial. The fact is that it is ours by right of, however you want to look at it, either discovery or purchase. The fact remains that we bought and paid for all of this land. We had to fight to secure it. We won. They lost. You know, if they complain about it, I would just tell them, cry me a river. I really don't care.
Well, I would have to agree that we are the dominant culture, and our fault is that we have allowed these people to survive in our culture so that they could get to a point where they could cry about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's our fault. Because if there were more of them than there were of us, they'd have eaten us a long time ago.
Absolutely, and the great tragedy is that we actually listen to them when they cry about it rather than telling them to go rot.
Exactly. And that shows that our society is sick. There's a sickness in Western civilization.
Well, we're basically the elephant being terrorized by the mouse, aren't we?
Well, yeah, that, but we're also we're infiltrated by Satan. And that's the disease. I mean, that's the corruption of all knowledge. That's the force that works against us no matter what we do. And that's not going to end until we realize who Satan is.
And who his children are.
Well, that's the point I'm trying to make. Satan is a collective entity. Satan's not an individual.
And I'll just go ahead and name it so any Jews that are listening or that download it later and listen to it will realize what I think of them. We can just refer to Satan as Jewry because Jewry is satanic.
Well, Jewry is Satan. There's no doubt. I mean, Islam is to a great deal Satan also. They're both manifestations of the same devil and the same gene pool.
Was it not Khomeini who called America the great Satan? Yet looking at a Judaized, Babylonianized America, it's easy to conclude that America's the great Satan.
Well, right. He was absolutely right because he was really talking about the Satan, the America that's dominated by the Jew banks. That's what he was talking about and by Wall Street. But the Muslim and the Jew got along just fine together for many centuries. Mm-hmm. And the Muslim was the pawn of the Jew in the destruction of Christendom in the Iberian Peninsula, in Eastern Europe. And they tried to evade. You know, Muslims were at the gates of Vienna 300 years ago.
1682. Most people don't realize that we narrowly averted catastrophe.
300 years ago. If the Muslims were successful in taking Vienna 300 years ago, they'd have been in Hamburg. There's no doubt.
And they would have been in Calais, and then eventually they would have been in London.
Right, absolutely. And this is only 300 years ago. That's not ancient history.
Our people have only been able to secure and safeguard the existence of our culture and our race through military prowess. Yet we're told that we're imperialist.
Military and technological prowess, especially, because we never had the numbers over the heathen masses, but we've always had the technology.
Yet we're told that we have to feel sorry for being colonizers, imperialists, and oppressors, where we narrowly averted, time and time again, being totally subjugated by these non-white hordes. The Mongols, the Tatars, the Cumans, the Bulgars, the Magars, the Uyghurs. In some countries, in some regions, portions of Russia, Ukraine, Romania, they're totally tainted by the legacy left by these tribals.
Well, look at what Charles Martel did and against the Arab hordes, the Muslim hordes in France. He was fighting Islam in France. I mean, that was 1,300 years ago.
732.
It's still just as real. The impetus for the Islamic invasion of Europe was the beckoning of the Jews who were upset that they could no longer loot and pillage Iberian Christendom, the Gothic kingdom, which they had been looting and pillaging for centuries. And they brought the Moors into Spain.
Well,
there are actually some pretty good books written about that. I have them somewhere. I have the references somewhere. The Plot Against the Church, I think his name is Maurice Pinay, P-I-N-A-Y. Clifton's quoted from him on occasion. It's a pretty good book.
I only have one
chapter of it, but it's a good book.
One thing I don't understand, then, is why in the Quran does it say the last hour would not come unless the Muslims will fight against the Jews, and the Muslims would kill them until the Jews would hide themselves behind a stone or a tree, and a stone or a tree would then say, "Muslim, servant of Allah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him." And that's from Sahaya, Book 40.
Okay, I've read parts of the Quran, but I mean, it's a polluted book. I would never think about reading the whole thing.
But I'm just wondering, why would the Muslims have in their holy book that on the day when it comes time for the Muslims to kill all the Jews, the Jews will hide behind trees and the trees will call out, "There is a Jew behind me"?
Well, I have at least three 18th and 19th century sources that tell me that Muhammad was half Jew, at least half Jew. And his father was also from an Arab tribe that had folded into it a number of Jews, the Korahites or something of the Arabian Peninsula.
You think he could have just been some neurotic, self-hating Jew that was trying to pass himself off as a non-Jew by hating Jews?
Well, I don't know, but Edward Gibbon, in the rise of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbon attests that Muhammad's mother was a Jewess. And that Muhammad's sources for the Quran were basically Jewish apocryphal, well, really Hebrew apocryphal literature, with a lot of stuff that he made up. And I read parts of it, and it's some real garbage. The Quran is garbage.
He stole some stuff out of the Bible, too.
Well, right. But from a scholarly viewpoint, I could say that the Quran was garbage. It's garbage.
Mm-hmm.
I would be speared and sautéed by 4/5 of world society, of the population of the world. But, yeah, the book they believe is straight garbage.
How many Muslims have actually read their own Quran?
Well, I don't know. I can't answer that. I've read pieces of it enough to know that it totally blasphemes Christ and the apostles.
Well, the Quran teaches that in the final day, the day of resurrection, or whatever the Muslim end of the world day is, that Christ, who is merely a prophet, will return along with Muhammad, and he will denounce himself, deny himself, and apologize that people took him for a deity when he was just a prophet, and then he will have some minor role in helping end the world and bring about judgment.
Yeah, but the average Christian is fooled by the Jew into thinking that, Islam recognizes Christ. Well, it does. It mentions him, but that doesn't mean that it recognizes anything of his authority or of his divinity or any of that. No, it actually does deny it. The Talmud mentions Christ, too. I mean, you could say the Talmud recognizes Christ.
Satan recognizes him, doesn't he?
Absolutely. That's why he's in the Talmud. The Jews have, basically, they're using Islam again to destroy Christendom.
So they're using Islam as a shield that they hide behind, and then they strike out at the West, but they don't have to.
Why is it that all of these Muslims just happen to be immigrating into every Western country while the Jews are identifying Islam as the enemy in the media and that we have to fight Islam over there?
Yes.
But we only have to fight them over there. Nobody's saying, while Britain's getting flooded with Islam, we have to fight Islam over there. Well, what about the streets in New York and London? Are they okay? Do they change magically when they cross the ocean?
So we have to go spill our blood in the mountains of Afghanistan, yet at the same time we have to allow London to become Karachi.
Right. And those Muslims in Iraq are absolutely evil. And Iran especially. But we're being flooded with them over here, and you can't say anything about it. Isn't there a dichotomy there in thought? Isn't there a serious conflict there in national interests?
Cognitive dissonance again.
Yeah, and it's absolutely the Jews behind the Islamic invasion of the West today, just like they were behind it 1,300 years ago and 300 years ago, because the Jews were behind the Turkic expansion also. The Jews, the Khazar, it's the Khazar Turkic Jewish trading empire. The Jews and the Turks and the Khazars, the Jews led the Turks and the Khazars around by the nose for 300 years.
Well, they're basically using their Mohammedan cousins against us so they don't have to directly face us.
Well, as we build up the Jew in Palestine technologically, territorially, in every aspect, our country, our nations are going downhill at the same time. This is an orchestrated effort. This is not a coincidence.
Well, were it a coincidence, it would be an awfully big coincidence that it is happening in every single white country around the world without pause and without relent.
Right, and I believe it's the fulfillment of Jeremiah 28 and 29. It's a fulfillment of biblical prophecy, and Yahweh foresaw it. But still, it's the devil that Yahweh's using to fulfill his prophecy, and it's evil, and we're not to accept it. Everyone who eats the sour grapes shall die, and the sour grapes are the mixed races and the race mixing, and that's evident from Scripture, from Deuteronomy. The sour grapes are the grapes of Sodom, the vine of Sodom.
I was going to say, I haven't read through Jeremiah lately. Could you summarize 28 and 29, if you want, please?
Well, basically, it says that Yahweh will sow the house of Judah and the house of Israel with the seed of man and the seed of beast. And everyone who eats the sour grapes shall die. This is a test for us and our race to see who's going to go along with the race mixing and who's going to resist it.
I'm reading here right now in Jeremiah 28, "For thus saith Yahweh of hosts, the God of Israel, I have put a yoke of iron upon the neck of all these nations, that they may serve Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and they shall serve him, and I have given him the beasts of the field also." So does this mean basically the entire world is going to serve Jewry?
Well, basically, that would be the entire world serving Mystery Babylon, yes.
And that's where we are today. The Jew basically owns the world.
Well, the beast has the kingdom. I mean, Revelation 17:17. It's Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 28 and 29 that I'm referring to. And it's just before the promise of the new covenant, which is actually done and over with. However, it's not yet consummated. And I believe that Jeremiah 31, 28, and 29 are talking about something that's going to happen before the actual consummation of the new covenant, which is what Jeremiah 31 actually promises. I discuss it at length and with all the proper citations in a paper on my website called The Immigration Problem and Biblical Prophecy.
This is a dual fulfillment issue here then, isn't it?
Absolutely. Right, the new covenant is promised, but it's not really consummated. The marriage supper of the Lamb isn't completed until the return of Christ.
So, until the Lamb is here.
Yeah, right.
So what was the historical fulfillment of this then? In what context? The first coming?
Well, that was the fulfillment of the promise, but the first coming. But the historical fulfillment of verses 28 and 29 is happening right now. And it's been happening ever since we've had this immigration problem. Probably the last 50 to 100 years.
What are the evangelicals trying to explain as these sour grapes? Everyone who eateth the sour grape, his teeth shall be set on edge. Everyone shall die for his own iniquity.
Right. The only way to understand the sour grapes is to go back. I don't have it in my head, but it's in my paper. To the passage in Deuteronomy where it talks about the bitter vine of Sodom. What were they doing in Sodom? Race mixing and homosexuality. What are we doing here? Race mixing, homosexuality. It's the same thing. That's got to be what it's talking about.
For their rock is not as our rock, even our enemies themselves being judges. For their vine is of the vine of Sodom and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall. Their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of dragons and the cruel venom of asps. Is not this laid up in store with me and sealed up among my treasures? To me belongeth vengeance and recompense. Their foot shall slide in due time, for the day of their calamity is at hand, and the things that shall come upon them make haste. For Yahweh shall judge his people and repent himself for his servants, when he seeth that their power is gone, and there is none shut up or left. And he shall say, where are their gods, their rock in whom they trusted? It seems to me that basically our people are trusting in all these idols, and their foot's getting ready to slide. It's sliding right now, isn't it?
Well, right, but we have a promise that Yahweh in the end will cleanse Israel, which is also detailed in the same paper I'm referencing, but I don't have it in front of me.
But until that time,
it's the final promise. The nations, the heathens, will know that Yahweh cleansed Israel.
But in the meanwhile,
and when the time comes, it's going to take us 7 months to bury their bodies. That's the promise of Scripture.
In the meanwhile, though, we are promised misery, suffering, catastrophe, and calamity, aren't we?
Well, right. For as long as we don't realize what's going on, wake up our eyes to it, and realize that the problem is really our own error and our own, well, I have to call it sin because that's what it is, but I don't really like to use the word, that the our own wrongdoing. And sin is acceptance of multiculturalism is sin.
Mm-hmm.
And acceptance of Satan is sin. And acceptance of the Jews is sin on the part of a Christian.
Sin
when a Christian embraces a Jew, he's sinning. He's sinning against God.
Well, anything that transgresses the law is sin. And we are told to love our neighbors, our kinsmen, as we love ourselves. And if we basically say that our kinsmen who lives in another state or another country matters less to us than some spook who lives four doors down, how are we loving our kinsmen?
Right. And the verses subsequent to Jeremiah 31:31 explain that Israel shall always be a nation. But other scriptures say that they will no longer be named Israel. Those Jews in Palestine, they are the children of Esau. Israel will always be a nation. Today they're called Anglo-Saxons because the Anglo-Saxons and the Germanic peoples of Scripture are the Israelites of the dispersion.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the Jews are the children of Esau, the Edomites of the Old Testament, and that's demonstrated fully in Ezekiel chapter 35, Romans chapter 9, the histories of Josephus, Revelations 2:9, Revelations 3:9, Malachi chapters 1 and 2, and in a lot of other scriptures and histories.
Well, Bill, question. When they speak about a nation, in the historical context, if it was, say I was in Greece at the time.
A goy is a people. It's not a geographical unit.
Yes. It's a racial entity.
It's a racial entity, exactly. It is not a geographical unit.
So Israel will always be a people in the sense that Israel, as a race, a people, will always survive, if not geographically, then in terms of blood.
Right. And those people are white Northern Europeans. They're not the that's who we are. We are the dispersion of Israel, which actually happened from 1500, because there was a dispersion of Israel before the Exodus, down through 586 BC. That's when Israel was dispersed. The dispersion of the Jews, as explained in Jeremiah and by Luke, is actually a dispersion of the enemies of God. The Edomites and the Canaanites. That's what the dispersion of the Jews is. The Jews are the enemies of God. Luke proves it. So does Jeremiah. They're the bad figs. And Harp is an idiot. That's the bottom line.
Well, when have the Jews ever been dispersed aside from when the Romans wrecked their Pharisaical kingdom in the first century A.D.?
Harp, I answered you on Jeremiah 31:32. The Jews were never a nation, period. Israel has always been a nation. The Anglo-Saxon nations, the Germanic nations, are Israel.
And even today, the Anglo-Saxon English-speaking people of the world still have that loose affiliation, the British Commonwealth, although it's rotten pretty much to the core, but they still have that affinity and that unity, that kinship bond.
Exactly. We're still a people. The only time we ever went to war with each other was at the Jews' beckoning. And because we succumbed to the Jews' beckoning, we've actually fought to eliminate our own race.
And we've done quite a job, haven't we?
Right.
All right, well, we're at 5:30 here. Would you like to, we should probably stop now and get ready for the next show?
Yeah, I still have a lot of, I have information glut. Jewish corruption, man, that's a huge topic. I don't know where to start and where to end. I guess I'll just take it as it comes.
Absolutely. And,
and try to follow Wiebe, and I know you have a lot to elucidate concerning economic corruption and the Jews.
Oh, absolutely. There's no shortage of material. If we wanted to talk about corruption and Jews, we could do that probably until the Second Coming.
Yeah,
but
absolutely. There's no end to it. It's incredible.
People might get tired of hearing about it, though, since with Jewish scandals, if you've heard a few of them, you know you've heard them all. People will be surprised, I imagine, those that tune in at 9 p.m. Eastern, they will be surprised to hear of the Jewish scandals in the 20s and the 30s in Germany, well, up to 33 when Hitler came in and put an end to it. They will be surprised. It will sound as though it's absolutely no different from the scandals and scams going on today in America.
Well, right.
It's the same throughout history.
It also happened to a great extent here in the 20s and 30s, but that's okay.
People will have to tune in at 9 p.m. Eastern on this same channel, and they will hear the third installment of Germany and the Jewish Problem.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. See you then. Yahweh bless.
Bye-bye.